content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the July 8th, 2022 issue of The Week. Looking at the cover drawing this week, we have in the foreground is Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito. He's crouched down. He's got his hands on the handle of, it's one of those old red detonating boxes we used to see in the movies with them setting off dynamite. He's got a big grin on his face, and he has the handle pushed down. Giant explosion in the background. In the middle ground, you see Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett and Neil Gorsuch. They're giving each other a high five. Behind them, Clarence Thomas has got his hands clenched with a big happy look on his face. And similarly, Brett Kavanaugh has both fists in the air with a big smile. The headline is "The End of Precedent." Conservative justices overturn Roe and turn the U.S. sharply to the right. Not surprisingly, that will show up in several places today. One of those is the first main story. Supreme Court overturns Roe. What happened? A woman's constitutional right to an abortion came to an end after a half century last week, as an emboldened Supreme Court conservative majority overturned Roe v. Wade by a vote of 6-3. The ruling, a long-sought victory for abortion foes that thrilled the Right to Life movement and caused anguish for supporters of choice, empowers states to decide on abortion's legality. As a result, abortion will be criminalized or severely restricted in 26 states and remain a protected right in 24. Roe was egregiously wrong from the start, wrote Justice Samuel Alito in the majority opinion, which was joined by Justices Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett. Alito said the 1973 ruling erred in its conclusion that the Constitution's 14th Amendment conferred an implied right to privacy and an abortion. Such a right, Alito wrote, is not deeply rooted in the nation's history and traditions. Chief Justice John Roberts voted with the majority, but wrote in a separate opinion that he would have taken a more measured course, upholding the 15-week abortion ban being challenged in the case, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, but not overturning Roe. The court's three liberals, Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan, wrote in a furious dissent that the catastrophic ruling strips away a long-established right that safeguards women's freedom, and did so only because the composition of this court has changed. Thomas wrote in a concurring opinion that the court should reconsider other rulings that used privacy rights to strike down laws banning same-sex marriage, gay sex, and contraception. The ruling immediately outlawed abortion in 8 states with trigger laws designed to go into effect if Roe were knocked down. In coming weeks, 18 states are expected to ban or severely restrict abortion, some with no exceptions for rape or incest. Blue state governors vowed to welcome women seeking abortions and shield them from the reach of red state laws. "As long as I am governor, this state will protect you," said New York Governor Kathy Hochul. What the editorial said: for the first time in history, the Supreme Court has eliminated an established constitutional right, the autonomy to decide what happens to your body, said the New York Times. In pursuing their nakedly ideological agenda, the justices' blithe dismissal of women's dignity and equality will usher in a new era of struggle over abortion marked by chaos, confusion, and human suffering. Finally, said the Wall Street Journal, 49 years after the court manufactured a constitutional right to abortion that exists nowhere in the document, it has corrected a mistake that damaged its legitimacy and inflamed our politics. The abortion debate will shift from the courts to state legislatures, where it will be decided by democratic means. Now both sides will have to pursue their objectives through persuasion, not judicial fiat. What the columnist said: this radical ruling is an assault on women's self-determination, autonomy, and equal status, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. Alito's ruling absurdly declares we are stuck with the precise state of the law that existed in the 19th century, a time when women couldn't vote or own property. His contemptuous dismissal of privacy rights declared war on modern America, revealing an arrogant court of super legislators determined to impose a view of the United States as a white, Christian, and male-dominated society. The court has become a tool of minority rule over the majority, said Jill Filipovich in The Guardian. Solid majorities of Americans believe in a right to an abortion. 68% said they wanted Roe upheld in a recent Wall Street Journal poll. But women have been stripped of the right to control our own bodies by far-right justices appointed by two presidents who lost the popular vote and confirmed by senators who represent a minority of Americans. Let us rejoice, said Caitlin Richardson in the Washington Examiner. The court has corrected an abominable ruling that told women murdering their children was not just permissible, but a fundamental right. The hundreds of thousands of defenseless unborn lives threatened each year will now have a fighting chance. For that miracle, I've got four words. Thank you, Donald Trump, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. Some may ask if his chaotic presidency was a fair trade for the three pro-life justices he installed. Yes. 1,000 times, yes. The human toll will be staggering, said Gia Tolentino in The New Yorker. Think of the teenage incest victims forced to give birth to their rapist children. The parents crushed by being forced to have an additional child they can't afford to raise. Any miscarriage can now potentially be investigated as a crime, with both women and their doctors subjected to digital surveillance, intrusive investigation, and authoritarian control. This decision won't bring us back to the days before Roe. We're going somewhere worse. Controversy of the week. January 6, an aide's devastating testimony about Trump. Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony landed like a bomb, said Ellie Honig in CNN.com. This week, the former White House aide blew the roof off the January 6 committee hearings as she offered a stunning blow-by-blow account of President Trump's unhinged behavior on the day of the deadly assault on the Capitol. Hutchinson, a special assistant to former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, said that Trump was warned his January 6 rallygoers were carrying knives, clubs, brass knuckles, stun guns, and spears fastened onto flagpoles, and outside the perimeter, even AR-15s, but still demanded that they be let in before the march to the Capitol. I don't effing care that they have weapons, she quoted Trump saying. They're not here to hurt me. The aide, 26, said an enraged Trump flung dishes against the wall when told the Justice Department found no evidence of election fraud. And she said she heard that when his Secret Service detail refused to take him to the Capitol to join the mob, Trump lunged for the steering wheel of the presidential SUV while shouting, I'm the effing president. With more revelations to come, this already rates as the greatest political scandal in American history, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. We heard strong evidence that Trump was repeatedly told of the potential for violence, but still actively encouraged his supporters to march on the Capitol and fight like hell. As the mob assaulted cops and invaded Congress, Hutchinson testified, White House counsel Pat Cipollone begged Meadows to get Trump to call them off, warning that people are going to die, only to be told by Meadows he doesn't want to do anything. Trump even told Meadows that Vice President Mike Pence deserves to be hung. When the coup failed, Hutchinson and other witnesses said, six Republican congressmen, Meadows and Trump lawyers Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman, all sought presidential pardons. Hutchinson provided the most extraordinary congressional testimony I've ever seen, said David French in the Dispatch, and the case for prosecuting Donald Trump just got much stronger. No doubt about it, Hutchinson's testimony was devastating, said Andrew McCarthy in National Review. But let's not forget that the January 6th panel is a highly partisan, anti-Trump committee, without a single GOP-approved member to cross-examine the witnesses. Secret Service agents reportedly dispute parts of her hearsay account that Trump physically struggled with them in the SUV. Even though the committee is steeped in partisanship, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, that doesn't mean Republicans should look away from the considerable evidence of Trump's wrongdoing, especially if he chooses to run in 2024. Public opinion is moving, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. A recent ABC News Ipsos poll found that 58% of Americans now believe Trump should be criminally charged. And GOP political consultants say even Trump fans not watching the hearings realize he would be a lot to have to defend. Republican donors and officials are tired of the Trumpian chaos and melodrama, said Jeff Greenfield in Politico, and are speaking about not fighting past battles and looking to the future. One new poll found Trump trailing his most formidable potential Republican primary opponent, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Thanks to the January 6th committee, the whispers in Republican ranks are growing. Maybe he doesn't have to be our nominee in 2024. It was a good week for golden handshakes after an office worker in Chile was accidentally paid the equivalent of $180,000, 286 times the usual monthly salary. The unnamed employee initially promised to reimburse the company, but did not, and has now disappeared. It was a good week for definite articles. After the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office approved the Ohio State University's bid to trademark the word "the" on sports apparel and merchandise, "the" has been a rallying cry in the Ohio State community for years, said a university spokesman. And it was a good week for everyone. After BioNTech and Pfizer announced they would begin testing in the second half of this year a new pan-coronavirus vaccine that would, in theory, provide protection against all variants. But it was a bad week for the week, which in the June 24th issue misidentified Donald Trump Jr.'s fiance in this space. It was Kimberly Guilfoyle, who was paid $60,000 in donated funds to introduce Trump Jr. at his dad's rally on January 6. It was a bad week for slips of the tongue after GOP Representative Mary Miller hailed the Supreme Court's reversal of Roe as a historic victory for white life at a Trump rally in Illinois. The crowd and Trump applauded. Miller later clarified that she meant to say right to life. Finally, it was a bad week for self-incrimination after former West Virginia lawmaker Derek Evans was sentenced to 3 months in jail for storming the U.S. Capitol. A key piece of evidence was Evans' live-streamed video of himself on January 6th shouting, "Derek Evans is in the Capitol." Thank you. This week's briefing is pain at the pump. Skyrocketing gas prices are squeezing working Americans and feeding inflation. How did we get here? How high are gas prices? Average gasoline prices hit an all-time high of $5.02 a gallon last week, up from $3.40 last December, a staggering hike of more than 40%. Why? The simple law of supply and demand. When the coronavirus shut down the world in the spring of 2020, global demand for oil plunged to the point where the cost of a barrel briefly dipped below zero. U.S. oil companies, sitting on brimming tanks of crude they could not sell, slashed production in response. Then, as Americans returned to work and traveled in large numbers last year, demand snowballed faster than oil producers had anticipated. They were severely behind the curve, said oil market analyst Patrick DeHaan. In February 2020, domestic oil fields were producing nearly 13 million barrels of crude daily. This February, the output was 11.3 million barrels. That same month, Russia invaded Ukraine, and the global supply took another hit. How did the war affect oil? Russia is one of the world's largest oil producers and the second biggest exporter of crude oil after Saudi Arabia. But when Western nations hit Moscow with economic sanctions to punish it for waging war on Ukraine, Russian exports plummeted. That sent global prices skyward. Because oil is traded on a global market, the reduction in supply raised the per-barrel price even for countries that didn't buy much oil from Russia. In the U.S., which banned all Russian energy imports in March, Russian oil made up less than 8% of the total. While Russia has found new buyers, the price of crude is now about $120 a barrel, nearly double what it was a year ago. The solution might seem straightforward, just have oil companies ramp up output. But it's not so simple. Why can't they just pump more? It's not like turning on a spigot. Companies that had shut down wells and laid off thousands of workers can't immediately pick up where they left off, so any effort to boost production now won't affect prices in the near term. Starting a rig takes 6 to 8 months, even without the pandemic-induced shortages of labor, equipment, and materials. And there's another problem: reluctance within the industry to invest in expanding production. As the U.S. and the world shift away from fossil fuels and toward renewable energy and electric and high-efficiency vehicles, long-term profits don't seem like a safe bet. Even though they see high prices today, said Christopher Niddle, an energy economist at MIT, they're afraid that prices are going to tank over the life of that well. As a result, oil companies are feeling pressure from Wall Street to use profits to reward shareholders rather than invest in new production. And even if production spiked tomorrow, all that oil couldn't quickly be turned into gasoline. Why not? We lack enough oil refineries. Since 2019, the U.S. has lost more than 5% of its refining capacity, more than 1 million barrels a day, as money-losing facilities have been shuttered or refitted to process biofuels. That trend has been mirrored in the rest of the world, which has lost an additional capacity of more than 2 million barrels a day. And just like with drilling, gas producers worried about drops in future demand are reluctant to make the investments required to expand capacity. Few new U.S. refineries have been built in decades, and none are planned. That means there are no quick fixes for consumers. And a high gas price doesn't just raise the cost of a fill-up. Because the U.S. is so large and so many goods are trucked long distances to stores, the price of gas affects the price of everything else, further driving inflation. Can President Biden do anything? Not a whole lot. The price at the pump is largely beyond his control. Biden has taken energy CEOs to task for failing to boost production and for their current record profits. And in May, he began releasing 1 million barrels a day from the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve. But neither their effort has had much effect, and experts agree his latest plan to suspend the federal gas tax of 18 cents per gallon would bring consumers little relief and may increase demand. Biden is also asking foreign suppliers to boost production. He's planning a trip to Saudi Arabia and has sent envoys to Venezuela, from whom we haven't bought oil since 2019. Those efforts, though, won't yield near-term relief, and neither would the Republican proposal to open more federal lands to drilling. Meanwhile, as summer travel picks up, so will the demand for gas. Anything goes from June 20th to Labor Day, said Tom Closa of the Oil Price Information Service. We could certainly see the national average approaching $6. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with condemn all political violence. With political violence growing on both the left and right, America is in a dangerous place, said David French. In recent weeks, pro-choice activists have firebombed pro-life crisis pregnancy centers, and a man showed up at a Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh's home with a gun. And progressives still haven't fully reckoned with the cultural and political impact of the George Floyd riots in 2020. Among Republicans, campaign ads featuring candidates brandishing weapons have become commonplace, and the Texas Republican Party recently passed a party platform that rejects the results of the 2020 election and raises the prospect of secession. The January 6 hearings have exposed the terrible threats made against election and state officials who dared to declare President Biden the rightful winner of the 2020 race. But if deciding which side is worse in your focus, then you're part of the problem. Instead, you should be standing athwart your own side's extremism and yelling stop. That means no more whatabouting when faced with violence from your allies. Every instinct telling us to minimize or rationalize our own side's misconduct pushes us closer to the abyss. To avoid catastrophe, we must all condemn political violence, period. The historical sophistry of originalism. The legal philosophy of originalism requires a very firm grasp of history, one that Supreme Court justices clearly do not have, said historian Joshua Zeitz. Take the court's ruling last week that a New York law restricting the carrying of firearms in public places violated the original intent of the Second Amendment. In the 18th century, a well-regulated militia had a clear meaning. States had the right to organize armed citizens for the common defense. At that time, states did regulate individual gun ownership, and local and state authorities frequently confiscated guns from persons they deemed a menace to public safety or simply disloyal. In the abortion decision, Justice Samuel Alito argued that the 14th Amendment provided no right for women to control their own bodies. Since in 1868, when the amendment was adopted, most states banned abortion. But when the Constitution was ratified in 1787, common law allowed abortion until the quickening, the second trimester. So in two rulings, the court's majority moved the goalposts, 1790s for guns, 1850s or so for abortion. This cherry-picking from history to achieve desired political ends is sophistry, not legal analysis. This is a How They See Us column from Europe. U.S. rolls back women's human rights. By reversing Roe versus Wade, the U.S. Supreme Court's radical conservative majority has delivered a profound and ominous setback for women's rights and for democracy, said the Irish Times in an editorial. Even though more than 60% of Americans believe abortion should be legal in all or most circumstances, the court's life-tenure far-right justices have now cleared the way for abortion bans to take effect in about half of the 50 states. The U.S. thus joins Catholic El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Poland as the only countries to roll back abortion rights in decades. Some European countries, it's true, restrict abortion at 12 or 16 weeks, earlier than Roe, but we also have largely free health care. So in practice, European women have easy access to abortion. Here in Ireland, the procedure was legalized by referendum in 2018, spurred by the 2012 death of Savita Halappanavar, who was denied the abortion that would have saved her life as she miscarried an unviable, wanted pregnancy. Halappanavar died in an Irish hospital as her husband begged doctors to help her. The U.S. has doomed itself to a future of similar tragedies. For any European who has ever been pregnant, said Rhiannon Lucy Coslett in The Guardian, the news from America felt visceral, as vicious misogyny often does. Pregnancy is a wholesale takeover of the body. I wanted my child, but having been through it, I know that forced birth would amount to torture. American women and girls henceforth will suffer, and at the explicit direction of the state. But not all of them, said Marius Oprea in Media Facts from Romania. Most rich women will still get the care they need, even if they have to travel out of state. But poor, especially black women, will either have unwanted children or try to self-abort. The U.S. healthcare system is utterly unprepared for the wave of abandoned newborns and mothers in crisis. Expect a health crisis of apocalyptic proportions. The ruling is further evidence of America's democratic collapse, said Le Monde from France. The extremist Catholic majority on the court is the product of the tyranny of a minority permitted by an electoral system outrageously favorable to the most conservative states. Donald Trump was defeated in the popular vote, yet became president anyway. He then nominated three ultra-conservative justices who were confirmed by a Senate whose makeup is permanently skewed to favor rural voters at the expense of the Democratic majority. President Biden often talks of a world at war between democracies and autocracies, said Miriam Martinez Buscanyan in El País from Spain, but we can no longer be sure the U.S. is in the former camp. The repeal of Roe is just the latest example of Republican obstinacy from the January 6 assault on the Capitol to the dying rage over firearms and efforts to restrict the black vote. And like the other examples, the abortion ruling will surely hurt America's standing in the world. How can the U.S. pose as the beacon of freedom against the authoritarian darkness of Russia or China when it denies its own female citizens their basic human rights? The last word, our feature article, titled this week, The Last Legal Abortions in Mississippi. After the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, patients rushed to the clinic at the center of the storm before it shuts down, said Richard Fawcett in the New York Times. Jackson, Mississippi. A young woman entered the parking lot of the only abortion clinic in Mississippi, her shoulders hunched. She was accompanied by an older woman and a stone-faced young man with a handgun on his hip. She appeared terrified. All around them, the noise was deafening. It was early Saturday, and a man with a powerful public address system was preaching about Jezebel being eaten by dogs. Dozens of evangelical Christians had come to pray. Volunteer clinic escorts, sweating in the summer heat, directed patients' cars through the throng and blasted music they thought the evangelicals would hate. At the moment, it was the cheeky alt-rock song, Stacy's Mom. Posters of aborted fetuses lined the street. A pastor named Doug Lane huddled with the older woman and encouraged her to persuade the younger woman not to go through with the procedure. I wanted her to have the baby, the woman said, her voice unsteady. Soon, all of this, the preaching, the frightened patients, the rock music, the bloody posters, will disappear. But before it does, there are guaranteed to be a few more days of roaring, passionate crescendo as the Jackson Women's Health Organization, the pink-painted clinic at the heart of the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, tries to see as many patients as possible before it is forced to close. There is already much talk about what will come next. Outside the clinic, opponents of abortion discussed how their churches might do a better job spreading the message of abstinence in a state with the nation's highest teen pregnancy rate. Supporters of abortion access, meanwhile, are working to create a network of donors, volunteers, educators, and even pilots to help women in the nation's poorest state travel to places where the procedure will remain legal. Similar efforts are underway across much of the country in states where abortion will now be forbidden. Abortion is our business, and that's what we're going to do to make sure women have access, said Diane Derzis, owner of the Jackson Clinic. We're not going away. This week, clinic officials said they plan to move it to Las Cruces, New Mexico. Abortion bans have already gone into effect in 9 states since Friday's ruling in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, with at least 12 more bans or restrictions, including in Mississippi, expected to take effect soon. Although it was a Mississippi law that sought to restrict abortion at 15 weeks that was at issue in Dobbs, the state also has a so-called trigger law, passed in 2007, that fully bans abortion, except in cases of rape or risk to the mother's life. That law is designed to take effect 10 days after State Attorney General Lynn Fitch certifies the Supreme Court decision. Fitch, a Republican, filed the brief before the Supreme Court defending Mississippi abortion restrictions. On Twitter, she hailed the decision as a victory, not only for women and children, but for the court itself. And at the beginning of this week, she certified the decision, which automatically activates the trigger law in early July. So right up to this week, the battle outside the Pink Clinic has continued, much as it has for years. The protesters have long been a fixture in Jackson's Fondren neighborhood, coexisting uneasily among its hip shops and cafes. They have been the subject of city council ordinances, police consent decrees, and incessant complaints from business owners. And they have been just one of the complications that have made operating the only abortion clinic in Mississippi exceedingly difficult. The intimidation factor, the social climate, the numerous legal hurdles, including a requirement that abortion providers give scientifically dubious health warnings to women, have forced the clinic to turn to a rotation of out-of-state doctors who have flown in and out of Jackson for years. On the day after the Supreme Court announced its decision, Lane, the pastor, said it was galling that the clinic was continuing to see clients even after the Supreme Court ruling. He was not in the mood to celebrate the fall of Roe, Rather, he said he would protect the clinic the same way he had since the 1990s, protest the clinic. "This is going to be the hardest 9 days of my life," said Lane, who, like others, erroneously assumed that the clock had already begun ticking for the clinic. Certification actually took 2 more days, potentially giving the clinic 11 more days in operation, because they shouldn't be doing abortions. All these other states closed their clinics down. Just a day earlier, Derzis, who lives in Birmingham, Alabama, and owns a number of abortion clinics, came to the Jackson Clinic and held a defiant news conference outside, her face partly obscured by big Jackie Onassis-style sunglasses. She spoke of a new clinic she was opening in Las Cruces, New Mexico, roughly 1,100 miles away, and about fundraising efforts to help women in Mississippi travel to New Mexico and other places where abortion will remain legal. "The fact that we're not here doesn't mean that we're not going to see Mississippi women and whoever needs us," she said. Derzis, 68, said she had an abortion in 1973 at age 20 in Birmingham while she was in college and living with her first husband. A year later, she went to work at a Birmingham women's clinic. Owning and operating such clinics, she said, has been her dream job, offering her the chance to help women in need. She also said she felt obliged at one point to get a law degree, given the obstacles her critics have thrown up over the years. Derzis said she would probably keep the phone number listed for the Jackson Clinic and might have the calls roll over to the New Mexico facility. Cheryl Hamlin, a Massachusetts doctor who has been flying to work at the Jackson Clinic, said that she was working on getting licensed in New Mexico so she could eventually fly there for work. She was also researching ways that Mississippi women might be able to obtain abortion pills online or in the mail or whatever. Hamlin said she was heartened by the new burst of enthusiasm around fundraising to help women travel, but she also worried that it might not be a long-term solution. "You know, that goes away," she said. The day that the Supreme Court announced its decision, Fitch, the Attorney General, posted a tweet saying that after the decision, government should strive to pass laws that empower women, including an overhaul of child support, child care, and workplace policies. That same day, the three dissenting justices in the Dobbs case, Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan, enumerated the many ways in which Mississippi has fallen short, with the highest infant mortality rate in the country, and some of the highest rates of preterm birth, low birth weight, cesarean section, and maternal death. They noted that although 62% of Mississippi pregnancies are unplanned, Mississippi does not require insurance to cover contraceptives and prohibits educators from demonstrating proper contraceptive use. In recent years, Republican lawmakers in firm control of the state have declined to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, a major reason critics say the state's health outcomes are so poor. In April, however, Governor Tate Reeves signed a law granting tax credits to supporters of pregnancy resource centers, which are usually aligned with faith groups and counsel women against having abortions. Terry Herring, president of the group Choose Life Mississippi, was optimistic that the strengthened centers would help poor women understand their options in the post-Roe landscape. "These pregnancy resource centers are going to provide that compassionate person to lead these people through their pregnancies," she said. "A lot of women just need to know how to access what is already available to them." As the temperature headed toward 100 degrees, the frustration of the clinic escorts was palpable. The street was narrow, and the escorts endeavored to shield the patients from the protesters as much as possible and assure that no pedestrians got hit. At one point, Dale Gibson, 53, a merchant sailor who volunteered as an escort, began screaming and cursing at a protester named Zach Boyd, who had been holding a small rubber fetus doll aloft every time a patient drove in. then shouting to patients through the fence, imploring them to repent and keep their baby. Boyd had moved Gibson's folding camp chair. Gibson objected and accused Boyd, who was standing at the border of the clinic driveway, of trespassing. An armed security guard intervened, trying to bring down the temperature. Gibson said he had had enough of Mississippi and was planning to move to California with his wife, Kim, who is a fellow escort. "We're living in a theocracy, okay?" Gibson said, adding, "If they think it's going to end with abortion, people are kidding themselves." Dursis said the day had been particularly busy, with 35 abortions performed and 25 counseling sessions for women who intend to have the procedure soon. As the last of the patients rolled in, Kim Gibson, who stood in the entrance to the parking lot, was sweat-drenched and exhausted. An anti-abortion protester, Madison Gass, 21, asked if she wanted a bottle of water. "All I want," Kim Gibson said, "is for y'all to vamoose." Boyd overheard her. "We will in 9 days," he said. "Praise the Lord." This story originally appeared in the New York Times. I'm going to pause today on a section we don't usually hit. It's called Best Properties on the Market. And it's not always relevant. It's sometimes interesting, but they either do different style homes or different areas of the country. And this one is called, this week, Homes in the North Carolina Research Triangle. And they highlight some nice homes. There's one in North Ridge and Raleigh for about $2.7 million. There's a Raleigh house for about $2.5 million. One up in Wake Forest for a small $1.75. Big home out in Chapel Hill for $4.25 million. There's one in Durham in the hills of Rosemont for, hey, this is good, $6.159 million. And the steal of the week is in Chapel Hill, a 1962 mid-century four-bedroom for just $495,000. The pictures make it, and they're a little hard to describe, but thought you might be interested in a little local flavor there. On the health and science page, we have light therapy for cancer. Surgeons have a hard time excising cancers in the brain because of the risk of damage to healthy cells. Now researchers have developed a promising new treatment that uses photoimmunotherapy to identify and destroy even microscopic cancer cells. They use synthetic molecules engineered to target a protein that often mutates in cases of glioblastoma, a common form of brain cancer. The molecules glow when exposed to normal light, and they trigger anti-tumor activity under near-infrared light. In a major trial involving mice with glioblastoma, the treatment helped surgeons identify and resect the tiniest cancer cells, and then, under the light, it wiped out bits that remained. The treatment also triggered an immune response that might help the immune system target new cancer cells to prevent recurrence. Brain cancers like glioblastoma can be hard to treat, study leader Gabriella Kramer-Merrick from the Institute of Cancer Research in London tells The Guardian. New ways to see tumor cells to be removed during surgery and to treat residual cancer cells that remain afterwards could be of great benefit. Vitamins, not much use. If you think vitamins offer you protection against cancer and heart disease, think again. That's the conclusion of an independent panel of experts at the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force. After a new review of 84 studies found insufficient evidence of any such benefits. The analysis covered the impact of minerals such as calcium, magnesium, and zinc, as well as multivitamins and vitamins A, B, C, D, and E. It concluded that the products could help certain groups, such as children, those with chronic illness or nutritional deficiency, and pregnant women who need folic acid to prevent birth defects. But for the average healthy adult, there was nothing in the analysis to support taking up dietary supplements. Far more important for preventing cancer and heart diseases, experts tell NBCNews.com, is eating well and exercising. A healthy diet is still the first line of defense against chronic disease, said Howard Sesso from Brigham and Women's Hospital, whose work was included in the review. Supplements by no means should be representing any crutch or any way to make up for an insufficient diet. And we're over on the Talking Points page, as usual, to finish out the show. We'll start with the article, Gun Legislation, Will It Change Anything? Do not underestimate the significance of this victory, said E.J. Dionne Jr. in the Washington Post. President Biden last week signed into law the first meaningful gun safety legislation in nearly three decades. With back-to-back mass shootings in Buffalo and Uvalde, Texas, providing renewed urgency, nearly two-thirds of the Senate voted to pass the bipartisan Safer Communities Act, which went on to pass the House 234-193. The law provides about $15 billion for states to enact and enforce reforms that include expanding background checks on 18 to 21-year-olds, strengthening school security, and tightening red flag laws that allow the confiscation of guns from people who present a threat. Much more needs to be done, including banning the assault weapons and high-capacity magazines that mass shooters often use, as well as raising the legal purchasing age from 18 to 21. Still, this legislation takes major steps in the right direction. Sorry, but the impact of this legislation may be negligible, said Abby Vasulis and Mother Jones. It provides funding to states to create red flag laws, but it's strictly optional. The safest bet to get anything across the finish line with Republicans, wary of taking any action on guns, lest they lose their re-elections. Senators John Cornyn, the Republican from Texas, and Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut, pushed the bill through Congress at breakneck speed so it would appear lawmakers were doing something about mass shootings, said National Review in an editorial. The result is sloppy, non-responsive, and rushed, and mostly reiterates or tweaks existing federal law. If anything, the new law may be worse than the status quo, said Robert Leiter in the Wall Street Journal. Progressives should hate it because its provisions are antithetical to their criminal justice reform agenda. Raising the maximum prison sentence for unlawful firearms possession and creating new racial disparities for gun ownership. Conservatives should hate it because the law is filled with vague definitions that unelected bureaucrats or judges will clarify in practice. Rather than provide robust gun control measures, said Sidney Fussell in New Republic, this legislation focuses on hardening campuses with CCTV cameras and armed guards. Turning schools into Orwellian fortresses won't stop the next mass shooting, but it will inevitably lead to even greater levels of surveillance and harassment of black and brown students. This is progress. Privacy rights. Is gay marriage next to fall. Overturning Roe v. Wade is a constitutional earthquake that may cause a host of other rights to crumble, said Damon Linker in his Substack newsletter. In the majority opinion, Justice Samuel Alito rejected the Supreme Court's longstanding view that the 14th Amendment implies a right to privacy, which served as the basis for Roe and landmark cases establishing the right to contraception, interracial and same-sex marriage, and gay sex. Alito took pains to insist those rights aren't in jeopardy, but conservative Justice Clarence Thomas wrote in a concurrence that the court now has a duty to reconsider all prior rulings based on a right to privacy, specifically citing the contraception, gay sex, and gay marriage cases. Given that the court's five hard right justices all come from a legal tradition that views those rulings as profoundly flawed, there may be more earthquakes in our future. Stop the hysteria, said Tiana Lowe in the Washington Examiner. There's no political movement to regulate the private behavior of consenting adults. Roughly half the states plan to ban or severely restrict abortion in the coming weeks. Compare that to contraception, which is viewed as morally permissible by 9 in 10 people, including 3 in 4 pro-lifers, and legal gay marriage, which the majority of Republicans now support. There's also a strong legal basis for distinguishing abortion, said Dale Carpenter in Reason. As Alito noted, only abortion poses the critical moral question of a potential human life. There are not 5 votes on this court to overrule the contraception and gay marriage decisions. Don't be so sure of that, said Iron Carmen in New York Magazine. In their blunt and righteously angry dissent, the 3 liberal justices assure Americans they're not crazy to fear other rights or on the chopping block. We cannot understand, the liberal justices wrote, how anyone can be confident that today's opinion will be the last of its kind. In denying that women have any constitutional right to an abortion, said Matt Ford in the New Republic, the conservative majority relied on the claim that such a right was not firmly rooted in the Anglo-American legal tradition. Is gay marriage the right to use an IUD or birth control pill? When the court decides states can ban those too, it should come as no surprise. A few of the shorter notes here. COVID vaccines saved the lives of 19 million to 20 million people worldwide in the first year of their availability, according to a disease modeling study published in British medical journal The Lancet. Officially, there have been 6.3 million deaths, but most experts think the number is far higher. Donald Trump had a mystery call with Russian President Vladimir Putin 9 days before the 2020 election, according to a British documentary filmmaker. Alex Holder, whose footage is the subject of a House January 6 subpoena request, said that White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows abruptly canceled Holder's scheduled interview with Trump and told him that the president was on the phone to the president of Russia. About 5% of U.S. active shooter attacks end with a bystander shooting the attacker. Of the 433 such shootings that took place from 2000 to 2021, 131 were stopped by police, 42 by bystanders without the use of a gun, and 22 when a bystander shot the attacker, often after many people had already been killed. The abortion rate among black women in 2019 was nearly quadruple the rate among white women and more than double that of Hispanic women. That disparity, said Guttmacher Institute, is largely the result of a lack of access and an effective use of contraception. About half of black Americans live in southern states, which will soon ban or severely limit abortion. On the poll watch, 57% of Americans think it's likely, somewhat likely, the Supreme Court will permit states to ban same-sex marriage. And 55% think access to contraception and birth control is at risk. Just 33% say they have a lot of confidence in the court. 64% of Americans favor laws that protect transgender people from discrimination, yet only 38% believe a person can really change genders. And we'll have a quote here from Audre Lorde. It's not our differences that divide us. It's our inability to recognize, accept, and celebrate those differences. And we've got time for a second quote. We'll go with one from Lee Trevino. He says, "You don't know what pressure is until you play for $5 with only $2 in your pocket." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.